This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 2 years ago, South African lawyer Albie Sachs opened his car door and a bomb explosion threw him 30 feet in the air. Sachs was an anti-apartheid activist, living in exile in Mozambique at the time. He was among the first whites to join the African National Congress and remains a member of the ANC's Constitutional and Legal Department. Sachs survived the car bomb attack, but he lost an arm and most of the sight in his left eye. He still has nerve problems in one foot and continues to find bits of shrapnel in his body. He's written about his recovery in his memoir, Running to Maputo. Maputo is where Sachs was living at the time of the explosion. He now lives in London. I asked him to reconstruct what happened during the assassination attempt.
Well, I didn't know it was an assassination attempt until afterwards, so I have to reconstruct not for you but for myself, and that was part of what writing it all was about. I can just remember something terrible was happening to me. I sort of blacked out. Everything was dark. I was swaying, and I felt a huge, like a punch against the back of my neck. And I thought I'd banged my head on something, like when I used to climb Table Mountain years and years ago in South Africa. And I'd be dreaming about the struggle and freedom in South Africa, and bang, you know, I'd crack my nut on an overhang and have that same sort of concussed sense. The only difference was this time the sense of concussion just didn't go away. The darkness stayed with me. And then I felt arms pulling me, and I realized this was something awful and threatening and ominous and directed at me. And I felt I was being kidnapped, and I can recall shouting out, leave me, leave me. I'd rather die here, something to that effect. And doing it in English, which is my mother tongue as a South African, and in Portuguese, which is the most widely spoken language in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, where I was working at the time. And I can also recall, in a half kind of a way, doing so, shouting out, but in a sort of polite way, because after all, I was a middle-aged lawyer in a public place, and I felt that I mustn't make too much noise. These are kind of half memories, half sensations, and then fading out completely and being a little bit angry, everybody around me talking earnestly, energetically, tensely, but about me as though I was an object and not to me as though I was a person. Well, and then once more total darkness, and then a voice coming through, very gentle and very kind voice, saying, Albie, this is Eva Garrido, you're in the Maputo Central Hospital, and we're going to operate, and you have to face the future with courage. And I was so happy just to hear somebody speaking to me and hear a good voice and to discover where I was. And then I sort of mumbled, still in the darkness, what happened, and a voice said to me, car bomb. And then I just remember like fainting, but fainting in a state of bliss, of euphoria, because I knew I'd survived, that I was okay.
You don't really remember all that much about what actually happened at the time, but you've asked friends who were following the news to help you reconstruct what happened. How much do you know now, and do you know who was behind the assassination attempt?
Well, this is very strange, because I didn't want to know for about 2 months. I didn't want anybody to tell me. It was enough that I'd survived. But subsequently, I saw it on a movie. There were two people with video cameras nearby. I saw it on photograph. I can't bear to look at those pictures. And then people like pieced together what had happened, and it appears that a car, my car was mined with a bomb that exploded as I was opening the door. I was on my way to the beach, and that seems pretty clear. And at one stage, loads and loads of people were saying they saved my life. And I would bump into people in Maputo, and they would tell me they dragged me away, and I just didn't recognize anybody. And now it's turned around a bit, and people are claiming we tried to kill him. And I've heard this from at least two different sources, as though they get some kind of pride in saying we were the ones. One was a black Angolan working for South African military who's been in custody in Maputo, and the other is a white South African lieutenant who belonged to the hit squad and gave a very extensive interview to South African press, claiming with great professional pride about how they, well, it's true that they didn't actually manage to kill me, but they did manage to get rid of my arm. And it was a highly professional job done by one of their top operatives. And he was indignant at the fact that this operative wasn't paid the full rate for the job. And he felt that this was most unfair.
So no one has been officially convicted of the assassination attempt?
No. And, you know, in a funny way, it doesn't even interest me very much to lock somebody up for this. Won't give me my arm back. It won't make South Africa a better place. But what is important is for the truth to come out, for people to know what happened. I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for other victims of police brutality and violence. But I know I feel very, very strongly in my whole being that if we just do the same to them as they've done to us, well, what's it all about? But if the truth comes out and we can stop this kind of behavior in future, and if these hit squads are disbanded, and if we can get a democracy in South Africa, then it's all worthwhile. And that is very, very healing.
In your memoir, Running to Maputo, you write about how during the process of recovery, you decided to not use a prosthetic arm. Do you still not use anything? You lost your arm right above the elbow. Do you still not
Correct.
Use a prosthetic device?
I don't use it. I tried so hard for 2 months. I wore the damn thing, and I practiced, and I just got more and more and more depressed. And I think partly I wasn't properly prepared for it, because people think if you lose an arm, the main problem is instrumental. The fact is, with one arm, you can do just about everything. The main problem is disfigurement. The main problem is image, your sense of yourself. And I just find that I manage much better as I am, exactly as I am, without the aid of what really is a cosmetic thing hanging on me and making me feel uncomfortable. I think everybody who's received an injury like this reacts in his or her own particular way. It's an extremely subjective thing. I just know that life is fun. I'm enjoying life very much as I am, and I feel unhappy when I wear the prosthesis.
Do you ever worry about making other people uncomfortable? By
that's
not wearing
it,
you know, because you have, yeah, right, uh-huh.
Yeah, that's like their problem. And people react to me the way I react to them. If I walk proud and I feel comfortable in myself, people feel comfortable with me. That's been my experience. If I feel timid, if I feel embarrassed, if I feel disfigured, then people pick that up. And I don't have any doubt about that.
My guest is Albie Sachs, and he's a member of the Constitutional and Legal Department of the African National Congress and director of the South Africa Constitution Study Center in London. He's written a memoir about his recovery from an assassination attempt, and it's called Running to Maputo. When did you join the ANC?
I seem to have been born into it, but I think, in fact, I became actively involved as a student age 17.
And what year was that?
That was about 1952.
And how did you get involved?
When I got involved, it seemed the most natural thing in the world. It was through a student group. There was a lot of sort of accidental meetings, but I'd grown up in quite a politicized home. My father was a trade unionist, my mother was politically active. So in that sense, I grew up in an anti-racist environment. But what was important was discovering these things for myself. And that I did with a crowd of young people, black and white, at university. And once I got in, it just seemed the most natural thing in the world.
What's your role in the ANC now?
My main work is on the Constitutional Committee. It's wonderful work. It's marvelous. We are the founding fathers and the founding mothers, if you like, of our Constitution. We're doing it very consciously. There are a lot of us, and we're very anxious to get as many people, non-lawyers, involved as possible in different ways. But we have a key role in terms of propositions, of formulations. We've got a super team, a very, very strong team of South African lawyers, either members of the ANC or very close to the ANC. And we're working flat out now in making, if you like, drafts of drafts for the Constitution. That's my main work. I've also landed in some very hot debates on culture in the New South Africa. I wrote a paper for the ANC for an internal debate which was subsequently released to the press, and that's provoked a tremendous discussion debate in South Africa. And I find I'm called upon constantly to speak about that.
Give me a sense of what you've called for that's so controversial.
Well, I said, although I'm totally against censorship of any kind, I would like to ban the statement that art is a weapon of struggle from our movement for 5 years. And I said, I'm somebody who's been saying this for the last 25 years. Let me explain why I feel that statement ought to be banned. And so the paper continues in that vein.
And why should it be banned?
Because it becomes a substitute for really facing up to transforming culture in South Africa. People just come out with it as a sort of incantation, as a slogan. And it diminishes art and it diminishes the struggle. It makes it seem as though art is something you haul onto the stage from time to time to liven up a meeting. When in fact culture really is who are we? We know where South Africa is. We don't know what it is. We don't know what it means to be a South African. And it's people in culture, in music, in dance, in poetry, in song, in painting, in film, in radio, who tell us what this thing is to be a South African, the thing that we're struggling for. And if we impose upon that tremendous enterprise a few rather banal slogans, we're not going to get anywhere. So the idea is not to separate politics from art, because you can't do it, but to allow the politics to come in a natural way for people who are already engaged in the struggle, who are spontaneously or by conviction anti-racist, but to be more daring, to take more risks, to explore more, not to be scared of contradictions, ambiguity, fun, tragedy, humor, and to get out of this very solemn way of presenting political art that most of us have been, and certainly I have been guilty of in the past.
You just returned from South Africa. Was this your first time back since your exile?
No, it was my first time back since my first time back. I went back, in fact, in May, June. That was my first time, my return after 24 years. It was an absolutely glorious return. I saw myself on American television afterwards, and it wasn't myself. This was a lunatic, somebody with shining mad eyes and a gaping mouth. And that's exactly how I felt at the time. It was just wonderful.
What impressions did you return with from your last trip? And what was the purpose of your trip?
The purpose was to go back the first time, just to feel the soil under my feet, to meet the people, to have that sense of joy and personal victory, if you like, of triumph, of achievement. This is what we've been fighting for. This is what we had achieved. Hundreds of meetings, nonstop, TV cameras following me around. It was a nice feeling to feel welcome in my own country. But also I wanted to see with my own eyes, what was it like? The South Africa I'd been talking about and urging people to impose sanctions against. What was it actually like to be there, to see the people? And the emotion was tremendous. I spoke mainly on university campuses. And I said, please, just a nice, quiet exchange of views. And people said, well, you might want that. The students are not going to allow it. There was singing, there was dancing. There was vivas, viva Albie Sachs, viva, almost like too much. But it was very warm. And I particularly enjoyed visits to Afrikaans universities, because these had been absolute citadels of racist, fascist, nationalist thinking. And the glow of the reception, the enthusiasm with which people there received me, was something more than just personal. This was like heart meeting heart. This was a sense of historic encounter, of tremendous achievement. And so I came away, I almost didn't have to fly back to London. I could have just clapped my 1.5 arms and I would have arrived.
The trip that you're describing, was that your first trip or your second trip that you've just described?
That was the first one. The second one, I've just returned, just before giving this interview, and I'm still glowing because it was a continuation of the first with perhaps a little less of the madness. And what was interesting was I noticed a lot of progress in the past couple of months, and even the short time that I'd been away. Things are moving forward in South Africa. There's a tremendous amount of bloodletting. A lot of people are playing their last cards, trying to sabotage the whole agreement, to say, as it were, I kill, therefore I am. I must be recognized at the negotiating table. And it's not even necessary to do that, because there will be place at the negotiations for everybody. So that's all very bitter. But side by side with the bitterness, and I think a much stronger force, is the force for renovation and change, and people beginning to develop a new outlook. Apartheid is still there. It's a very divided society. It's a very unequal society and a very racist society. But what has changed is the outlook of people. And people, black people, are discriminated against, but you sense they are not oppressed in the way they were when I left South Africa. There's a sense of burgeoning freedom, a sense of achievement. And a lot of whites I met felt a thrill of release from the shame of being associated with apartheid, an enthusiasm that they can use their talents and their skills in a creative way. Many other whites are uncertain, they're unsure, they're nervous, but there's an openness that we never had before in South Africa.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how it's felt over the years to be a white member of the African National Congress.
I've really felt myself really to be Albie in the ANC, and it's very rare the whiteness as such crops up. But I remember once when it did, it was at a funeral of a colleague and comrade friend of ours, Eddie Weinberg, a photographer, at a memorial meeting, and one of our African black comrades said, and Ellie was always willing to eat with us, and he made great sacrifices to be in the struggle with us. And I was the next speaker, and I changed what I'd prepared to say, and I said, I just want to say that I'm sure Ellie would have rejected the idea that he was making sacrifices, that it was an honor and a joy to be in the liberation struggle. And that's the way I felt. The cultural question is always with us. There are always things to learn. The race question never goes away, even in the best of movements, and I think we are one of the best of movements. But it's basically been a very positive experience, and I think I can say a wonderful life.
I know in the American Civil Rights Movement, there was a point, for instance, when SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, asked its white members to leave, and this was in part because of the feeling that whites would end up in leadership positions and end up in some ways patronizing the black members. And in order for blacks to really have self-determination within the civil rights movement, there'd have to be a period in which whites were not officially included in the membership of certain groups. Was there ever talk of such a thing in the ANC, or do you think that South Africa was in a very different kind of situation?
We moved in exactly the opposite direction. When I started off, I was in a separate organization for white supporters of the ANC. And progressively, we became integrated into the ANC. It was a question of a process evolving. And when you look at our leadership, I mean, who's going to patronize Nelson Mandela? Who's going to patronize Oliver Tambo? These are great leaders of world stature. We're extremely proud of them. They are happy to work with all South African patriots who believe in democracy in South Africa. And I think maybe what makes a big difference in South Africa is you have a very large, very confident, strong black majority in the society and a white minority. And the black majority have shown enormous generosity in a way that the white majority haven't shown in the United States. And this somehow makes it much easier for human relationships to emerge and evolve in the context of the ANC.
When you were living in South Africa as a lawyer, you spent time defending anti-apartheid activists. Did you always feel that the courts and the legal system was stacked against you? Was it possible to ever win?
Well, we measured winning by... At first, we actually won in the 50s when I started. We actually won. We got our clients off. But after Sharpeville, 1960, the banning of the organizations, everything going underground, we just had to try and manage loss and reduce. If somebody didn't get the death sentence, that was a victory. If somebody was sentenced to 15 years rather than 25 years, that was a victory. If we could expose a little bit of torture, I mean, there was a lot of torture, but give a little exposure to it, that was a breakthrough. And we were really using the tiny little crevices available in the legal system to defend people as much as possible and to expose as much as possible. Now, of course, we're thinking about a complete transformation of the legal system, using what was good there, and there were a lot of very profoundly good features in the South African legal system, but detaching them from the defense of apartheid, from the whole race of structures. To this day, there are still only white judges in South Africa. And, of course, making the law anti-racist and having a new constitution. So if anybody's looking for a good job, there are good jobs going for good judges in South Africa.
Have you seen Nelson Mandela since his release from prison?
Yes, I've seen him twice, briefly. And, of course, they were quite emotional encounters.
You used an alias when you were recovering in a London hospital from the assassination attempt on your life. When did you start using your name again and feeling comfortable about letting people know where you were?
You know, the alias was adopted by the London hospital that didn't want to give its name away.
Oh, because they were afraid that they would be vulnerable too?
Possibly. And it created enormous confusion in records, and the psychiatrist who came to see me was totally against it. I said, I'm also totally against it. So I never really used the alias there. It was just really for record purposes. Afterwards, when I came out of hospital, I acted in a kind of clandestine way, but the purpose wasn't to keep my enemies from getting at me. It was to keep my friends from reaching me. It was just too much. There were too many people. I had no privacy. There was just so much love, like pouring in, and so many people wanting to see me that I was just becoming destabilized. So I went into hiding from my friends. I've come out again.
Do you have any fear of another attempt on your life?
No. You know, I feel I'm indestructible. It's a strange kind of feeling. But I sort of don't care. And one of the things was I went back to Maputo as soon as possible, 7 months after the bomb. I deliberately went back to confront the scene of the explosion. And I just knew that psychologically this would lift the dread, and it did. And I'm so thrilled with what's happening in South Africa, and I'm so happy with my own recovery, and so happy to be back. And, of course, it's marvelous having the book coming out, and it's been, so far it seems to be very well received, and people like it, and so on, that I'm just feeling, what more can they do to me?
Do you have any plans on returning to South Africa to live?
Yes, I'm definitely returning. It's a question of finding a place, and I know what I want. I want to be able to hear the sea when I wake up in the morning and when I go to sleep at night. And I'm taking steps to find that place.
Albie Sachs, I thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Albie Sachs's memoir is titled Running to Maputo.